You are listening to the Temple Bible Church Sermon Podcast. Learn how you can be a part of the ministry of TBC by visiting templebiblechurch.org.
Good morning. Before we get started, I want to remind you that we are at the end of our gift drive. This is the last week for our gift drive here at TBC. And every year we sponsor about 50 families in our community, and we feed them, we get them food for Thanksgiving holidays back in November, and we do a gift drive for those 50 families at Christmas time. And there's still some ways for you to get involved in that. We need a lot of help still. If you go to the hub on the church website, you will see three ways in which you can give and donate. You can give money towards a lunch that will happen this coming Sunday, next Sunday, in the Creekside building. And you can also donate toys still. And if you go to the toy link, you're going to see that today is the last day to donate toys. But we all know that today is not the last day to donate toys. So we still need lots of toys donated, so please give towards that this week. And then thirdly, you can volunteer to host a table or to sign up to volunteer to help with the lunch at the Outback next Sunday. It'd be great if we have lots of smiling faces to represent the body of Christ next Sunday at the Creekside building. For those families, when they show up for a lunch, then they're going to be able to go and get some gifts for their kids and their families afterwards. So love for you to do that this week and get all those slots filled up. And then one other thing, in between services, someone came to me and said, there is a white Toyota Highlander, here's a license plate, KVR2124. If you're like me, I don't even know my license plate, so good luck with that part. But the white Highlander may ring a bell. There were keys that were found right by that car, and those keys are at the desk there in the lobby if those belong to you. Please only take those keys if that car is indeed yours. I don't want to give you any ideas, but, you know. All right, this is week number two in our Advent season, and we are going to be in Isaiah chapter 7 and 9 today. And we know there are some prophets, like the prophet Jeremiah. Jeremiah was considered the weeping prophet. And some prophets shared a lot of inner turmoil and struggles when they wrote their book. So for Jeremiah, as he wrote his book, he was an open book himself. And Isaiah is not really like that. Isaiah says little about himself. This book focuses more on the message, not so much the man. Isaiah's message can be summarized in the meaning of his name, Yahweh is salvation. He probably lived in Jerusalem, and we know he was married, and he was a father. The book tells us that he prophesied in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. These are all kings of Judah, the southern kingdom. And he began his prophetic ministry around 740 BC. Now, in previous generations, God made these promises to Abraham and to David about how, through their descendants, God would bring salvation to the world. But the generation to which Isaiah is writing, they no longer trust those promises. Instead, out of fear, they begin to align themselves with evil human powers. We also learn a lot about Ahaz, this king of Judah, in 2 Kings chapter 16, that we learn that King Ahaz was an evil king. If you remember, at this time, the kingdom is split into two. There's the northern kingdom, that's Israel, and the southern kingdom, that is Judah. And we know that Ahaz led Judah into idolatry he would set up these altars to burn incense to pagan gods. In fact, there's really strong evidence on some of those altars in that part of the world that they would burn cannabis on those altars. This gives new meaning to the idea that Ahaz set up the high places for worship of false gods. Now, so he set up these incense altars, and they also burned some other stuff on those things as well. And we learn also that Ahaz followed the way of pagan kings by sacrificing his own son on the altar. So they'd worship this god called Molech, and many of the pagan nations would worship this god, and they would sacrifice their own children to these gods. And Ahaz began adopting those habits and murdered his own children to appease these pagan gods. So he's an evil, evil king. And we also see how, once again, the Bible matches up with archaeology, because they recently found this seal of Ahaz. They found this inscription. It was like a seal that you might use to stamp some official document. And the words "belonging to Ahaz, son of Jotham, king of Judah," are found on this little tiny piece of this archaeological find. It's fascinating to think about. But around 735 BC, Assyria is up in the northern eastern section of that area of the world. And Assyria is a growing threat. And so Israel and Syria, not to be confused with Assyria, Israel and Syria create this alliance to defend themselves from possible attack with the Assyrians as a threat. So Israel and Syria, they go to the south and they attempt to get Judah to join their alliance by attacking Judah in the south. It's kind of a strange way to put out the warm vibes with Judah, right? To attack them in order to get them to join in their alliance. But out of fear, instead of trusting God, Ahaz goes to Assyria to seek protection, and it all blows up in his face. In the first five chapters of the book of Isaiah, God confronts Judah in their sin because they are diligent in their sacrifices, but their hearts have grown far from God. And this is seen in their treatment of the fatherless and the widow. And in chapters 7 and 9, where we're going to be today, we see a powerful theme, and it's this: grace through judgment. We normally don't associate those words together, grace and judgment, but you're going to see how in this part of Isaiah that God is bringing judgment, but he's also showing grace and providing a way for the nation to receive grace in the midst of that judgment. In chapter 7, the king of Syria and the king of Israel, they come to Jerusalem, they come south to Jerusalem to attack Judah. And in verse 2 of chapter 7, it says, "The heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind." Now, I don't know where you were in late May when that storm hit Central Texas, but if you had a view of the trees through the windows wherever you were, I was over in the Outback with a bunch of students over there, and it was a scary situation. And I was trying to stay away from windows during that storm, but I looked out one window of the Outback, I could see just one tree just snap in half right there by the street. But wherever you were during that storm, you probably, if you saw the outside, you saw these trees just violently shaking in the wind. And that's the descriptor used in Isaiah 7:2 to describe what Ahaz and the people were like when they knew this threat was coming down from the north to possibly invade them. So they're terrified, and God tells Isaiah to go meet Ahaz, and he says, tell him not to listen to these threats, but tell him to trust God for ultimate protection. So look at Isaiah chapter 7, verse 10. "Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol," that would just mean the grave, "or as high as heaven," that would just simply mean the sky. "But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test." So Ahaz, he placed his faith in human power rather than God. So God invites Ahaz. God makes this crazy invitation to Ahaz. He invites Ahaz to request a sign to strengthen his faith. Now, why wouldn't God just give him a sign? Well, God wants him to ask. He wants him to have a heart that's dependent upon him. But Ahaz refuses the sign. God's offering it to him, saying, hey, ask a sign so I can give you confidence that I'm going to keep my promises. And Ahaz says, you know, I'm not going to ask that of you, God. I don't want to put the Lord to the test. He almost sounds noble as he's making this excuse about why he didn't want to receive the sign. He probably has in mind Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 16, which says, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. But there's a problem, because he outwardly obeys one law while breaking another, because he's planning this unholy alliance with Assyria, which is a violation of Deuteronomy chapter 17, which says, you should not make alliance with foreign kings. And I think this is what you and I do. We obey outwardly while secretly disobeying in some other area. One writer says it like this: there are situations in which outward piety and inward unbelief are identical. There's all kinds of ways that we do the same thing, where we have this, where we showboat a little bit. We want to outwardly obey and show ourselves to be obedient in certain areas. But meanwhile, We're harboring secrets. We know what those things are. And we're truly disobedient in many other areas that God wants us to obey him in. And this is what Ahaz is doing. He seems almost showy with his obedience. Like, I don't want to test God. That'd be wrong for me to do. But meanwhile, he's disobeying God's request to ask for a sign. And God says, I'll give you a sign if you'll just ask. I'll give you a sign as deep as Sheol, the grave, or as high as heaven, the sky, or anything in between. And so just look at God's grace here. Because if God sees just a spark of faith in Ahaz, he is willing to give a sign to fan that spark into a flame. But Ahaz refuses to ask, and so now Isaiah turns to the whole nation. Look at verse 13. And he said, this is Isaiah, and he, meaning Isaiah, and he said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. You can just hear the exhaustion in the words of Isaiah. But again, look at the grace of God. Ahaz refuses this sign that God wants to give him, but God gives him a sign anyway, and it happens to be a prophecy of the that would point to the coming Christ. This is the grace of God embodied in the Son. So Ahaz refuses the grace of God, and God says, I'm going to give you grace anyway. I'm going to give you grace incarnate. I'm going to give you grace in the flesh. And he promises to send this sign in the form of a child. Now, this prophecy seems straightforward to many of us. We pull these passages out around Christmas time, read them, of course, and we just tend to see it fairly simple and straightforward. It's a little more complicated than that. There are really three primary views. There's really more than that, but I've got about 35 minutes with you. And so I'm going to give you three views of how many would interpret this prophecy. The first view is that there was only an immediate fulfillment right after the prophecy. That's view number one. Like an immediate fulfillment right after the prophecy was made. That there was a boy who was born shortly after Isaiah spoke these words. And there was a young woman who was a virgin, and she got married and conceived the natural way, and she gave birth the natural way. That's how some may interpret that. And there are some that believe this child was born to Isaiah. This is unlikely because Isaiah's wife already had a baby, so she would not have been a virgin when this prophecy was made. That's the first way of viewing this prophecy. The second way is to view it only as future, only as pointing to Jesus in the far distant future. And this would refer exclusively to the birth of Christ and the Virgin Mary as his mother. Also, some problems with that view because the verses that follow here seem to indicate at least part of this prophecy was fulfilled in the near future. So look at verse 15, where we see evidence of this. It says, he shall eat curds and honey when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. So eating curds. Now you know that the symbol of the promised land was what? It was a land flowing with what? Milk and honey. Now, when it comes to curds, that's like thick, sour milk. Think of cottage cheese. Don't think about cottage cheese. It's not an appetizing thing to think about. But that's what's being in our minds here. And so eating curds, we know curds don't really flow, do they? So eating curds and honey, that's like a picture of a time of poverty in the land following the Assyrian invasions. That's what's being imaged here. And this seems to refer to a birth that's in close proximity to the prophecy. Isaiah says, there's going to be a birth, and before that baby reaches the age of discernment, you know that age, maybe 2-3 years old, where your kids start to understand what right and wrong is. Now, they might still choose the wrong most of the time, but they still understand what right and wrong is usually around that age. And many think that's what's being talked about here, like around the age of 2 or 3, the age of where they understand between good and evil in some capacity. And the prophecy here is that the alliance between Israel and Syria is going to be broken when this child reaches that certain age. And that's just what happened. 2 years later, after this prophecy was made, in 732 BC, Assyria attacks the Northern Alliance, and the two kings whom Ahaz feared were no longer a threat. So the first two views that I just gave you, that it was only immediate or only far in the distant future, I don't think those are the correct ways of seeing this prophecy. There's a third way to see this prophecy. And to help us understand it, I'm going to utilize Grover from Sesame Street. I'm bringing my academic A game today, just so you're aware of that. But you will never see prophecy the same again when I explain this to you. So if you know Grover on Sesame Street, he has this kind of real goofy way of explaining the concepts of near and far to children. And I almost played the video, but I didn't want to stoop down and you know, insult your intelligence today, so I didn't play it. But he, you can watch it later on YouTube if you want. But he explains the simple concepts of what near and what far means to children, right? Well, when it comes to interpreting prophecy like this especially, you've got to understand that there is a near fulfillment, but there's also a far and distant fulfillment. It's both. And so we interpret it in both ways. The prophecy is partially fulfilled by the birth of a baby during Isaiah's time, but ultimately fulfilled by the coming of Jesus Christ. If you see it this way, it will help you understand how to look at prophecies throughout much of the scriptures. There is this near fulfillment, but also a far and distant fulfillment. We know it ultimately points to Jesus because of how Matthew uses the passage in Matthew chapter 1. When an angel appears to Joseph to confirm that Mary is going to give birth as a virgin, we see in Matthew 1 these words: "She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet," that's Isaiah, "Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel," which means God with us. How do we know that Isaiah refers to the coming Christ? Well, Matthew tells us that. God tells Ahaz that to ask for a sign, and Ahaz refuses, but then God gives him one anyway. The birth of a baby that would ultimately be a rebuke for his unbelief. You know, around the Christmas holidays, many of us get all warm and nostalgic and sentimental this time of the year. But from a biblical standpoint, Christmas is not that sentimental, because the prophecy of this baby was a rebuke. It was a rebuke to an unrepentant king. In a similar way, the prophecy of Jesus coming in the flesh was a rebuke to an unrepentant people. It reminds me of the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians when Paul writes, "But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong." Paul's writing to the church in Corinth, and Corinth is this cosmopolitan city. Now, we might think that God would only choose the elite of the elite to reach a city like that, but God doesn't do that. Paul reminds them that God always does the opposite. When has God ever chosen what is impressive on the outside, impressive to the world, to accomplish his purposes? He didn't do that with Joseph, Moses, Ruth, Samuel, David, Esther, the whole nation of Israel, all the disciples. We know their stories. And he doesn't do that when he sends Jesus. So how would God bring the world's empires to their knees? By sending his son as a baby. From a human perspective, there is nothing more non-threatening than a baby. But this is how God used what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, and how he used what is weak to shame the strong. I think almost every young couple I know right now has a baby they're carting around all over our campus here. It seems that way. And when you look at these little babies, you just go, there's nothing more helpless, nothing more non-threatening than a baby. And yet, that's how God chooses to send his son in this way, to shame the wise and to bring empires to their knees, to shame the strong. This is what God chooses to use in history. to bring human governments and empires to their knees in worship of him. This is how God does it. And so I want you to go down now to Isaiah chapter 9, starting in verse 1. But there will be no gloom for her who was in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he has made glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the nations. So when Isaiah says, for her who was in anguish, he's referring to Israel, this northern kingdom, that's about to be attacked by the Assyrians. So how do we know? Well, if you look at a map of ancient Israel, you're going to see some tribes, Zebulun and Naphtali, close to the Sea of Galilee up there in the north. And God allows this area to be in anguish because they were attacked by the Assyrians and to live in contempt. But in the latter time, meaning the time of Christ, it says he has made glorious the way of the sea. Now, why is this significant? Well, this is the very place around Galilee where Jesus began his ministry. This is a picture of many of us at TBC a couple years ago at the Sea of Galilee, on the Sea of Galilee. And you'll see in the middle there, the middle of the boat, there's Mark Wood, one of our elders here. And the reason why his hands are spread like this is because he's talking about the idea that when you are on the Sea of Galilee, it's crazy to think about this. You can see, of course, from one side to the other fairly simply. And 70 to 80% of Christ's ministry took place in that region. Most of us don't think of it like that. We think of him just being in Jerusalem. But most of his time was spent there in the north in the Sea of Galilee area, in that region, because God promised he would pour out his blessing through the ministry of Jesus in this area before he would eventually head towards Jerusalem. And this is interesting because from a human perspective, we might expect Jesus to show up in the city of Jerusalem, like the epicenter of Judaism. That's what we would expect. Have you noticed how no matter where someone is from, everyone looks down on someone? Rome would have looked down on Jerusalem. Jerusalem would have looked down on Galilee. We still do this today. We know that everyone from New York makes fun of New Jersey. I'm from Virginia, where we always make fun of West Virginia. North Carolina looks down on South Carolina. And Texas looks down on everyone. That's why I moved here. I was tired of feeling inferior. Except Texas can't look down on Georgia right now. I know that, right? So is that too soon? Too soon. I apologize. I was pulling for him last night. I really was. But the reason in which Jesus starts his ministry would have been seen this way, as some backwater town, some backwater area that nobody respected. Remember in John chapter 14 when one of the apostles, Nathanael, he learns that Jesus came from Nazareth. And what does he say? He says, can anything good come out of Nazareth? Why would the Messiah come out of a place called Nazareth, which is also up there in the north? The ministry of Jesus began the same way that his life did. He's born into obscurity. His ministry begins in obscurity. And why is that? Because God uses what is foolish to shame the wise. He uses what is weak to shame the strong. If you're not yet a Christ follower, maybe you're of the intellectual skeptic type, and you just can't wrap your mind around this idea of faith and Christianity, and why would you follow after someone that came here 2,000 years ago, supposedly, and you have lots of questions and doubts about this whole thing. And maybe for you, one of the hangups is that I just can't follow Christ because that would just lose respect in the circles in which you run. But do you realize that's exactly how God set it up? He set it up so that the empires are brought to their knees because of people worshiping him in this way. Do you realize this is how he set it up? That the weak is gonna shame the strong, that the simple is gonna shame the wise. It's gonna look foolish to the world to be a Christ follower. That's written into the story, you see. And in Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 to 16, right after John the Baptist is arrested, that's when Jesus departs Nazareth and goes to Capernaum, which is by the Sea of Galilee. And it says in Matthew 4 that in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that was what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. And then Matthew quotes Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 and 2. Look at verse 2 in chapter 9 of Isaiah. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwelt in a land of deep darkness, on them light has shone. Chase mentioned last week how we associate Christmas with lights. And this is not by accident, because throughout history, Christmas has been celebrated right after the winter solstice, which is December 21st, which is the darkest time of the year for much of Europe, especially up there in the north, and the Mediterranean world. It's one of the darkest times of the calendar, that time of year. And so it makes sense that we celebrate Christmas with lights, lots of lights. I remember several years ago, my family and I, we went to the Middle East to go visit some goers that we have over there. And our kids were still pretty young, so we didn't want to have some crazy 18 to 20 hour flight all the way there and all the way back. So on the way back, we decided to have a little layover in London. And it was around like late November. We actually spent Thanksgiving Day in London. And just so you know, they don't celebrate Thanksgiving over there. We did it at a restaurant on our own. But it was weird being there in that part of the world in the fall, late fall, because it gets dark around 3:30 in London in the afternoon. And so we're walking around the town and it's dark, like it's night, but people are still at work in this darkness. And so that's the image. That's why part of the reason why we have lights at Christmas time is when this was being celebrated initially, it was literally dark in that part of the world, at that part of the calendar. And it's partly why we have lights are so associated with Christmas, because it's not simply for decoration, it's highly symbolic. Because we know the world's a dark place. And we know our lives are dark places apart from Christ. Many of you can remember walking in darkness before you came to know Christ, or dwelling in a land of deep darkness, but the light of Christ and his grace, it shined into your life and you were changed miraculously. And he did that for you. We see the gospel in this passage because in the same way that Ahaz was given this sign that he didn't ask for and did not deserve, we are given light that we don't deserve. Jesus is associated with light because we cannot see ultimate reality unless Jesus is our light. So how is the world dark? What does it mean that the world is dark? Well, in the Bible, the word darkness refers to two different kinds of darkness. It could be evil, but it could also be ignorance. I think you know about examples of evil, but here's what we do. We try to solve the problem of evil in man-centered ways, and that's a different kind of darkness. That's the darkness of ignorance. You see, at the end of Isaiah chapter 8, we see the people are consulting spiritual mediums and magicians instead of God. And the chapter ends, in chapter 8, it ends with these words, and they will look to the earth, but behold, distress and darkness, the gloom of anguish, and they'll be thrust into thick darkness. The people are looking to the earth to solve evil. They are looking to experts and philosophers, mystics, magicians to solve the problem of evil. And so their ignorance is making the evil worse. And so today we look to the earth to solve evil as well in our own ways. We turn to politics and financial markets, technology. We believe that we can use our intellect and innovate our way out of evil. I want you to pay attention to any of the secular Christmas movies that you might see during the season. You're going to see this theme, that each of us has some light inside of ourselves. And if we just come together and shine our collective light on the world, then we can have peace, unity, and we can dispel the darkness. And that we can do it ourselves. That's what they will tell you, directly or indirectly. But whenever we turn to our own devices to solve evil, evil only gets compounded. Evil only grows exponentially when we do that. And the words are clear here that we don't possess the light. It needs to come from outside of us, and it's Jesus. It is Jesus. And we see that in verse 2. Skip down to verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, And his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. The opening phrase of that, of verse 6, it says, for to us a child is born. That's really important because it shows his humanity. But the second phrase is equally important because it says, to us a son is given, and that shows off his deity. Do you know the early church had these heresies that they fell into with many of the churches in that time? And the early church heresies would question not the deity of Christ, but the humanity of Christ. Today we have it reversed, where people often question the deity of Christ and not so much his humanity. But both are essential, his humanity and his deity. He is fully human, but also fully God. And the four titles that are used here can only belong to someone who is God. Everlasting Father does not mean the Son is the same as the Father. They're both God, but they are distinct persons of the Trinity. The title emphasizes his relationship to time, everlasting, not his relationship to the other members of the Trinity. The word Father describes how he's going to reign. He's going to rule like a father. And this title, Wonderful Counselor, indicates that Jesus knows exactly how you and I struggle because he experienced it for himself. A couple weeks ago, I took my daughter to get her braces put on. She's 14. And we know that, of course, today they do braces. They do two rounds of braces now. It's kind of nice, right? And her orthodontist is a really nice guy, and he said they're going to be using this new kind of ceramic bracket on her instead of the old stainless steel kind that most of us had as kids. And of course, I had some questions about how they would fit and how they would feel for her and everything. And he said, well, he said, I actually put them on myself for about 6 months. And I said, yeah, but your teeth weren't crooked, so why did you do that? And he said that he wanted to see what it would be like so he could better understand what his patients were experiencing. And I thought that was profound. And I thought, so you decided that instead of trying to explain to the 14-year-old girl what this would feel like theoretically, you put these things on yourself and experience it for 6 to 8 months so that you could empathize and relate to what they're going to go through. And he's like, yeah, that's what I did. And there's a profound lesson for us in that, because this guy subjected himself to what his patients go through so he could empathize and give good counsel, and that's just what Jesus did. In Philippians chapter 2, verse 7, it says, Jesus emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Jesus subjected himself to our experience so that he could not only just empathize with us, but be our substitute, fully man and fully God. That's what Jesus did. It means that Jesus knows what it's like to be abandoned by friends. It means that he knows what it's like to experience injustice. It means he knows what it's like to suffer. It means he knows what it's like to die. And so when you and I pray to him, you can have confidence knowing that he understands exactly what you're walking through. He understands you perfectly. He knows the road that you're walking in. Dorothy Sayers, she writes these words, the incarnation means that for whatever reason God chose to let us suffer, to be subject to sorrows and death, he has nonetheless had the honesty and the courage to take his own medicine. He can exact nothing from man that he has not exacted from himself. He has gone through the whole of human experience, from the trivial irritations of family life and the cramping restrictions of hard work and lack of money, to the worst horrors of pain and humiliation, defeat, despair, and death. He was born in poverty and suffered infinite pain, all for us, and thought it well worth his while. There's no other religion that could even make that claim, that their God, whoever they worship, stooped so low and went so far as to incarnate himself and in the flesh dwell among humanity. No other religion would even make that claim. It'd be foolishness to them and to their religion. So I want you to go back to this phrase in Isaiah 9, where it says, to us a son is given. This means, if something is given to us, that means what? It means it's a gift. We can't earn a gift. I think we know that. Imagine if you gave Christmas gifts to your kids, and then you said, now you owe me $500. That wouldn't go over well, of course, but it also would be inaccurate because it's no longer a gift if they're having to pay for it. That's not a gift. He offers us the gift of salvation, but it can only be ours if we recognize it as this gift of grace. You know, at times in the holiday season, of course, there's all this gift giving and receiving, and we know that can be a distraction for many of us. But on the other hand, it's an appropriate way to point us to a spiritual truth. Because receiving some gifts will make you swallow your pride. Do you understand that? How, when you receive certain gifts, you have to swallow your pride to receive certain kinds of gifts. Like imagine opening up a present on Christmas morning from your significant other. Maybe it's your boyfriend or your girlfriend, husband or wife, and they give this to you as a gift. Now, I love the for dummies types of books because there's just some, no matter what the topic is, there is some humility required to go and purchase a book that's for dummies. You're admitting that you don't know anything about the topic in hand. And I'll also say that that has to be one of the creepiest pictures for a book I've ever seen on the front cover of that. Like, how do you get better at relationships? You can start by not hand feeding her pizza. Let's start right there, right? But all that aside, if someone gives this to you as a gift, there's a backhand element to this gift if you give it to somebody like that. But if you receive a gift like this, there has to be some humility to receive it as they give this gift to you. Or how about this one? What if someone gave this to you as a gift this Christmas? I probably just gave someone a gift idea out there, I think, maybe, possibly. But if someone gives this to you, right, there's an element of this. If you receive it as a gift, you're admitting some pretty hard truths about yourselves if you take this as a gift from someone else. We know that receiving gifts like this requires humility and some admission that you have some flaws and some weaknesses. And I think that's true of receiving almost any kind of gift. Maybe some of you have been in dire straits financially at some point in your life, and someone showed up in a profound way and gave you a gift to bail you out of that situation, whatever it may have been that you were in. And you remember how it required you to swallow your pride and to humble yourself just to receive it. And you said, I'll pay it back. And they're like, no, don't pay it back. It's just a gift. And it was hard for you to receive that gift. There's something inherent to a gift that is humbling and forces us to swallow our pride. At the heart of the gospel is a gift, and it's Jesus, that requires us to humble ourselves and to swallow our pride or to receive it. Tim Keller writes these words, "There has never been a gift offered that makes you swallow your pride to the depths that the gift of Jesus Christ requires us to do. Christmas means that we are so lost, so unable to save ourselves, that nothing less than the death of the Son of God himself could save us." It's humbling to know that nothing less than the death of the Son of God can save us. And we can only receive this gift by first confessing our need for his grace. Today I want to invite you just to close your eyes for a moment. I'm going to pray for you. We're not going to have a final closing song. We're just going to pray. And as you sit there in this quiet moment, I want you just to be thinking and reflecting on what you've heard today. And I want to invite you, if you're someone that's not yet a Christ follower, and you've been wrestling with this truth that to receive the gift of salvation, to receive the gift of Jesus, the gift of his grace, you recognize that it requires humility. It requires an emptying of yourself to receive the gift that he wants to provide for you. It's a gift that cannot be earned. And as you reflect about that this morning, if the Holy Spirit is convicting you of your need for him, then you, as I pray here in a moment, you can just pray to him and tell him that and confess your need for him and admit that you're a sinner separated from him because of our sin. Admit that you have violated a relationship with a holy God. And admit that you need him to be a part of your life. And confess to him that you'd like for him to rule and reign in your life. And that you want to surrender to him today. That invitation is on the table for you today. In the same way that Ahaz was offered this invitation from God to receive a sign. And Ahaz refused. That in God's grace, he wants to offer you salvation today. And I hope that you say yes to him today. You can pray to him in your own way and just tell him that through prayer. And I'm going to pray for you as you may be doing that in your seats. God, we thank you for your words, these prophetic words so many years ago. We thank you for the confidence that they give us today in our faith, knowing that you spoke these so many years before you came in the flesh and dwelt among us, knowing that these were, that your birth was prophesied and predicted to happen hundreds of years before it actually took place. And God, we can have confidence knowing that your word is true and that you are true to your word. And God, I pray that if there's anyone here today that doesn't yet consider you a, they don't consider themselves a Christ follower, I pray that today they would come to know you, that they would fall on their face before you in worship, in surrender and submission, recognizing that you want to give them grace and you want to give them this gift. God, I also pray for anyone here that is a Christ follower, but they've just kind of grown cold in their faith towards you. And God, we know that this season of time, we just do the same thing year in and year out, and yet we've grown complacent. Our hearts have grown cold towards you. God, would you reawaken and reinvigorate their faith during this season of time? And may it not just be something that happens seasonally, but it'd be daily and weekly and monthly and yearly for them as they recognize this idea of grace, the idea of you coming in the flesh, the idea of your blood on the cross, the idea of your resurrection. Those concepts should never lead to boredom. Those concepts should never lead to complacency. And God, may they spur us on mission as we live our lives here today and beyond. We pray this in your name. Amen.